You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The French Revolution set Europe ablaze. It was an age of enlightenment and progress, but also of tyranny and oppression. It was an age of glory and an age of tragedy. One man stood above it all. This was the age of Napoleon. I'm Everett Rummage, host of the Age of Napoleon podcast. Join me as I examine the life and times of one of the most fascinating and enigmatic characters in modern history. Look for The Age of Napoleon wherever you find your podcasts.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 295th episode of our Civil War podcast. My name is Rich.
And I'm Tracy. Hello y'all. Thanks for tuning into the podcast.
As the calendar rolled over from June to July 1863, the Siege of Vicksburg entered its seventh week. Pemberton and his men despaired of rescue, and a feeling of gloom hung over the beleaguered garrison like a shroud. Federal saps had reached the outer ditch at several points along the 8-mile line of crumbling earthworks. In some places, the Confederate soldiers could hear the ominous sound of mining operations beneath their feet.
In other spots, the rebel and Union soldiers were separated only by the battered parapet itself. By July 3rd, everyone knew that time was about to run out for the fortress city and its defenders.
For the civilians and soldiers who had endured so much for so long, the events of May 17th must have seemed like a distant memory. Back on that day, when the Confederates poured into Vicksburg following the debacle at the Big Black River, Alex S. Abrams, a newspaper correspondent from Georgia, had observed, quote, "A feeling of despondence could be observed among the troops, and curses, loud and deep, were hurled at Lieutenant General Pemberton for his mismanagement of the army, many of the troops declaring their willingness to desert rather than serve under him again."
Pemberton was aware of the widespread criticism of his leadership, but he didn't comprehend the depth of the discontent within the army. The seriousness of the situation was finally impressed upon him by a letter from Division Commander John Bowen, who warned that the, quote, "wildest and most absurd rumors of surrender are in existence, not only among the men, but the officers of the command."
The note informed Pemberton that the federal prisoners were saying that he and Grant had an understanding and that Vicksburg would be theirs before May 20th. In light of these dreadful rumors and their effect on morale, Bowen urged Pemberton to proclaim his determination to hold the city. Alarmed by the possibility of a mutiny, the Confederate commander followed Bowen's advice and issued a proclamation that read in part, quote, "You have heard that I was incompetent and a traitor, and that it was my intention to sell Vicksburg. Follow me, and you will see the cost at which I will sell Vicksburg. When the last pound of beef, bacon, and flour, the last grain of corn, the last cow and hog and horse and dog shall have been consumed, and the last man shall have perished in the trenches, then and only then will I sell Vicksburg."
Needless to say, talk of eating dogs didn't exactly make for much of a pep talk, but in the end, Pemberton's proclamation served its purpose and talk of mutiny faded away. In fact, morale improved noticeably following the repulse of the federal assaults on May 19th and 22nd. Of those who had thought ill of Pemberton, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Bevere of the 5th Missouri said, quote, "They judged their general wrong. He was incapable of harboring a thought of treason. He may not have been an able commander, but he was brave, and they soon found that he would surrender to nothing but starvation.
And as far as starvation, Pemberton was as good as his word. Rations for the garrison were reduced again and again, until by the end of the siege, each rebel soldier subsisted on only a handful of peas and rice every day. Water was also rationed, eventually at the rate of just one cup per day, barely enough to maintain bodily functions. The streams that supplied Vicksburg originated east of town, behind Union lines, and to make life as miserable as possible for the Confederates, the Federals threw animal carcasses into the streams to render the water unfit for drinking. Needless to say, the shortage of water was exacerbated by the terrible heat and humidity of a Mississippi summer.
Disease added to the suffering caused by the scarcity of food and water. Dysentery, diarrhea, malaria, and a host of other sicknesses ran rampant through the rebel ranks. As was always the case in a Civil War army, more men died from disease than from combat.
Thousands of Confederate soldiers ended up in the hospitals as the siege dragged on. Those who remained in the trenches bore mute testimony to the hardships of the siege, with their glazed eyes and emaciated forms.
As the calendar prepared to roll over from June to July, Pemberton began to lose hope. He realized Joe Johnston would not or could not force the Federals to lift the siege. That meant there were just two choices left to Pemberton: surrender or attempt to cut his way out through the encircling enemy siege lines.
In June, Pemberton had ordered hundreds of small boats constructed and concealed in warehouses along the waterfront. However, the idea of crossing the Mississippi River to the Louisiana shore was soon abandoned, since it would have been suicidal for the Confederates to make such an attempt in the presence of David Dixon Porter's Federal gunboats.
Pemberton also had considered breaking out at South Fort, the southernmost point of his landward defenses, where the Warrenton Road ran south along the edge of the bluffs overlooking the Mississippi.
And Grant was slow to close off that avenue of escape because of lack of federal manpower in the early stages of the siege. But by the time Pemberton seriously began to consider escaping from Vicksburg, it was too late. Union reinforcements had arrived in substantial numbers, and Grant had extended the interior line south and west all the way to the banks of the Mississippi below Vicksburg. And once that happened, the Confederates were trapped.
On July 1st, Pemberton issued a communication to his division commanders. Most of them had already reached the same conclusion, but still Pemberton spelled out the situation for them, saying, quote, "Unless the siege of Vicksburg is raised or supplies are thrown in, it will become necessary very shortly to evacuate the place."
Pemberton then directly expressed his own thoughts, writing, quote, "I see no prospect of the former,"
that is, of the siege being raised,
"and there are many great, if not insurmountable, obstacles in the way of the latter,"
that is, of more supplies getting into Vicksburg.
And since time was of the essence, Pemberton urged his subordinates to report, quote, "with as little delay as possible as to the condition of your troops and their ability to make the marches and undergo the fatigues necessary to accomplish a successful evacuation."
The response from his lieutenants was almost unanimous. They reasoned that for a breakout attempt to succeed, they would have to place the Big Black River between themselves and the Yankees in a single day's march, or else Grant's larger and more mobile force would pounce on them.
Since there were no draft animals left inside Vicksburg, the army would have to abandon its artillery and wagons, which meant that the men would have to carry a substantial load of gear, ammunition, and rations. Given the circumstances, however, in their severely weakened condition, they wouldn't hold up for long under the stress and strain of a forced march. In light of the realities of the situation, Pemberton's subordinates stated their belief the soldiers had suffered enough and recommended that, quote, an immediate proposition be made to capitulate.
Years later, Engineer Officer Samuel Lockett recalled that Pemberton was so distraught he flirted with the idea of leading a suicidal attempt to break through the encircling enemy lines. Lockett quoted Pemberton as saying that such a desperate act was the, quote, only hope of saving myself from shame and disgrace.
Again, according to Lockett, Pemberton eventually submitted to a higher sense of duty and acknowledged that a more noble course of action would be to bear the humiliation of surrender, that is, quote, to sacrifice myself to save the army, which has so nobly done its duty to defend Vicksburg.
It seems unlikely the plain-spoken Pemberton would have expressed such flowery sentiments, but he may well have expressed thoughts along those lines.
The Confederate soldiers trapped at Vicksburg expressed themselves in much blunter language. Despite all sorts of deprivations and hardships, they still maintained a certain dark humor right up to the end, as when they warned the Federals just across the lines to, quote, look out, as we have a new general, General Starvation.
But they too realized the game was up. A remarkable letter from the ranks made its way to Pemberton and confirmed his decision to surrender. Entitled An Appeal for Help, the letter urged the general to bring matters to a close, quote, if you can't feed us, you had better surrender us. Horrible as the idea is, then suffer this noble army to disgrace themselves by desertion.
The document was signed, Many Soldiers.
Pemberton informed his lieutenants that he would offer to surrender the garrison on the 4th of July. He explained that he likely would be able to obtain more favorable terms from the enemy on Independence Day. With this hope, Pemberton opened communications with Grant.
As the sun rose on Friday, July 3, 1863, Federal soldiers quickly noticed the presence of white flags fluttering above the earthworks near the center of the Confederate line. Even as the firing picked up along other portions of the lines, near silence reigned here in the center. Then, mid-morning, Lieutenant Colonel Lewis Montgomery of Pemberton's staff and Division Commander John S. Bowen rode out of the besieged city and made their way to the Union lines. They delivered a letter from Pemberton to the Federal commander requesting that an armistice be granted in order to arrange the terms for the capitulation of Vicksburg. Grant's answer was typically blunt. Quote, the useless effusion of blood you propose stopping by this course can be ended at any time you may choose by an unconditional surrender of the city and garrison.
Grant recognized that he was the master of the situation. He had fought too long and hard to demand anything less than unconditional surrender. Those were the terms he believed he owed to himself and his army.
Bowen and Montgomery returned to Vicksburg. In the company of his generals at Army headquarters on Crawford Street, Pemberton reviewed Grant's terse reply. Pemberton had hoped for more favorable terms and was disappointed in Grant's lack of leniency. Then, in the discussion that ensued, Bowen stated that Grant seemed to desire an informal meeting with Pemberton to discuss the matter of surrender. Encouraged by this additional information, which Bowen completely made up, Pemberton informed Grant that he would like to meet him on the Jackson Road that afternoon.
Shortly before 3 o'clock, flags of truce again appeared atop the Confederate works, and firing along the center portion of the lines sputtered to a stop. Grant appeared along the Jackson Road, accompanied by Corps Commander McPherson and Division Commander Andrew Smith, among others.
Grant was in good spirits. He later wrote, "It was a glorious sight to officers and soldiers on the line where these white flags were visible, and the news soon spread to all parts of the command. The troops felt that their long and weary marches, hard fighting, ceaseless watching by day and night, in a hot climate, exposure to all sorts of weather, to disease, and worst of all, to the jibes of many northern papers that came to them saying all their suffering was in vain, that Vicksburg would never be taken, were at last at an end, and the Union sure to be saved."
A far more solemn group of horsemen emerged from the besieged city. The two groups of officers met in a low piece of ground between the lines, dismounted, and shook hands. Grant later recalled, quote, "Pemberton and I had served in the same division during part of the Mexican War. I knew him very well, therefore, and greeted him as an old acquaintance."
Pemberton, however, was ill at ease and responded stiffly to Grant's greeting. An awkward silence ensued as both commanders waited for the other to begin discussing the matter at hand. Pemberton finally said that it was his understanding Grant had requested the meeting. He was shocked when Grant said that was not the case. Pemberton turned to Bowen and declared, "Then there must be a misunderstanding. I certainly understood differently."
A red-faced Bowen then admitted the meeting had been entirely his own idea. Getting the two commanding generals together here on this day would be John Bowen's final contribution to the Confederacy. He was already ill with the dysentery that would claim his life just 10 days later, on July 13th.
Pemberton then noted that in Grant's letter of that morning, he said he had no terms other than unconditional surrender. Grant nodded, saying, "I have no others."
"Then, sir," answered Pemberton, "it is unnecessary that you and I should hold any further conversation. We will go on fighting again at once."
Apparently feeling the need to end the meeting on a defiant note, Pemberton then said many more Union soldiers would die before Grant entered Vicksburg, and that the garrison had sufficient rations to hold out for weeks still. The Federal commander knew that such talk was largely bluster, but he didn't want to let this opportunity to bring the siege to an end then and there slip away. So Grant proposed that he and Pemberton step aside while McPherson, Bowen, Smith, and Montgomery discussed terms of surrender.
Pemberton agreed to Grant's suggestion, and the two generals then walked a short distance away, and in the shade of one of the few trees still standing between the opposing lines, they sat and reminisced about their days in Mexico.
Meanwhile, the other four officers hammered out a list of mutually acceptable terms of surrender. When Grant heard the proposed terms, however, he rejected them as too lenient, but informed Pemberton that he would submit alternate conditions that evening. After agreeing to continue the truce until the next day, the two groups of officers mounted back up and went their separate ways.
As they parted, Pemberton undoubtedly took some satisfaction from the fact that he had gotten Grant to agree to a negotiated surrender, while Grant must have been pleased that victory was almost certainly just a few hours away.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. My name is Wesley Livesey from the History of the Second World War podcast. My podcast is a mostly chronological retelling of the Second World War, and I hope you will join me on a journey through the most cataclysmic conflict in human history as we try to answer the questions of not just what and where, but how and why. Join me on a journey not just through the famous campaigns, battles, and events, but also on a trip around the globe as we broaden the scope of Second World War history beyond the well-known battlefields of Europe and the Pacific. During weekly episodes, I seek to provide new insight for longtime students of the war, while also being a great jumping-on point for anyone seeking a deeper understanding of the Second World War. This podcast has made it to the invasion of Poland in 1939, and start listening now to find out how the world would find itself embroiled in its second worldwide conflict in just 20 years. You can find History of the Second World War on all major podcast platforms or at historyofthesecondworldwar.com.
Rumors spread like wildfire among the soldiers of both armies. The men believe that the meeting of the two commanding generals surely signaled the end of the struggle for Vicksburg was at hand. The afternoon of July 3rd was oppressively hot. Despite the truce, occasional shots still rang out along the lines. Around 5 o'clock, though, the last shot of the siege was fired, and complete silence enveloped the countryside around beleaguered Vicksburg. After weeks of unceasing combat, the soldiers of both armies found the silence to be strange and unsettling.
To Lieutenant Richard Howard of the 124th Illinois, quote, "The silence began to be fearfully oppressive. For so many long days and nights, it had been a continuous battle. Not a minute, but the crack of a rifle or the boom of the cannon had been in our ears, and much of the time it had been deafening. Now it was still, absolutely still. It was leaden. We could not bear it. It settled down so close it hugged us with its hollow, unseen arms till we could scarcely breathe."
On the other side of the lines, Captain William Foster of the 35th Mississippi said, "I heard the shrill note of the artilleryman's bugle. It was the first time I heard the blast of the bugle during the siege. In a moment, our cannon ceased firing. The enemy beyond the river also ceased, and the stillness again rested upon the peaceful bosom of the Father of Waters."
Although an end to the bloodshed and suffering in this particular corner of the war appeared to be at hand, the chaplain added that a, quote, "painful silence, foreboding evil, reigns over the doomed city."
Upon returning to his headquarters, Grant informed Admiral Porter of what was happening and asked that the Navy honor the ceasefire. Then he sent for his corps and division commanders holding the interior line. And this was the only time in the campaign that Grant held something that might be described as a council of war.
Sherman and the other generals stationed on the exterior line were watching Johnston's Army of Relief on the far side of the Big Black, and so didn't attend.
Exactly. At any rate, Grant told everyone of his meeting with Pemberton. He said that while he still favored an unconditional surrender, or something close to it, he was willing to make a few concessions in order to bring matters to a close. Grant then asked for suggestions as to terms of surrender.
To Grant's surprise, his subordinates urged him to make Pemberton an offer of parole. They argued that transporting 20 or 30,000 captives up the Mississippi River to prisoner of war camps in the Midwest and feeding them along the way would tie up an immense amount of shipping and consume a mountain of resources.
Parole meant that the Confederates would promise not to take up arms against the U.S. government again until properly exchanged, but they would be free to leave Vicksburg. Afterward, the hard-pressed Confederacy would have the responsibility of transporting, feeding, and looking after Pemberton's defeated and demoralized army of non-combatants.
Parole was a major concession indeed, but after thinking it over, Grant anticipated that it would be welcomed by Pemberton's weary soldiers. He ordered, quote, unquote, some discreet men placed on picket duty that night, quote, to communicate to the enemy's pickets the fact that General Grant has offered, in case General Pemberton surrenders, to parole all the officers and men and permit them to go home from here.
Grant believed that many dispirited rebel soldiers would be quick to latch on to this generous offer and would make their feelings known to their superiors. He also thought, or at least hoped, that many would simply leave for home, that is, desert, after the surrender of Vicksburg.
As promised, Grant sent his amended terms of surrender through the lines that night. Pemberton submitted them without comment to his division and brigade commanders. The assembled generals thought the conditions were as good as they could expect and urged Pemberton to accept them.
Pemberton took pen in hand and informed Grant that, quote, in the main, your terms are accepted, end quote, by which he meant the offer of parole.
But then Pemberton attempted to reopen negotiations. He proposed to consummate the surrender the next morning, quote, by marching out with my colors and arms, stacking them in front of my present lines, after which you will take possession, end quote.
By this, Pemberton meant that the garrison, rather than sticking around, would simply march away from Vicksburg after giving up their flags and weapons. He assured Grant that this arrangement would, quote, perfect the agreement between us.
By now it was after midnight and it was Independence Day, and Grant was in no mood to delay the inevitable any longer. He agreed to a limited surrender ceremony, which was an important point of honor in the 19th century, but he insisted that the Confederates then return to their camps in order to be properly paroled, a process that involved a great deal of paperwork.
Determined to bring matters to a close, Grant warned Pemberton that if he did not receive a conclusive response to his terms by 9 o'clock in the morning, quote, I shall regard them as having been rejected and shall act accordingly.
Pemberton knew the game was up. Enough blood had been shed in defense of Vicksburg. He informed Grant, quote, the terms proposed by you are accepted.
On the morning of July 4th, 1863, white flags appeared along the entire length of the Confederate line. Around 10 o'clock, those Confederates who still had the strength to do so marched out from their works, furled their flags, stacked their arms, and then returned to their camps.
The victorious soldiers of Grant's Army of the Tennessee then marched past the empty defensive works and took possession of Vicksburg, the capture of which had been their goal for so long.
For the Federals, the capture of the Confederate Gibraltar on the Mississippi was a strategic victory of almost incalculable proportions, and arguably the greatest single feat of arms achieved by either side during the entire Civil War. In addition to receiving the surrender of a garrison of almost 30,000 men, the Federals seized a huge amount of military stores and equipment, including 172 artillery pieces, 29 tons of black powder, 50,000 firearms, and 600,000 rounds of ammunition, all of which represented resources in men and material that the Confederacy could ill afford to lose.
Ulysses S. Grant rode into Vicksburg on the Jackson Road, past the ruins of the 3rd Louisiana Redan. He stopped at the Warren County Courthouse and watched as the Stars and Stripes were unfurled atop the building. Then he rode down to the waterfront, where he congratulated Porter and thanked him for the invaluable assistance rendered by the Navy during the long and costly campaign.
The fast steamer V.F. Wilson was sent racing upriver to Cairo, Illinois, with the news that Vicksburg was at long last in Union hands. Almost as an afterthought, Grant sent a similar message downriver on the ram General Price, informing Nathaniel Banks of the victory.
When the V.F. Wilson reached Cairo, the electrifying news was telegraphed to the War Department in Washington and rushed to the White House, where a happy Abraham Lincoln declared, "I cannot in words tell you my joy over this result. It is great."
When added to the reports of federal victories at Gettysburg in Pennsylvania and Helena in Arkansas, the news from Mississippi made it a positively glorious 4th of July for the Union.
That means it's time for this episode's book recommendation. And our recommendation this time is Port Hudson, Confederate Bastion on the Mississippi by Lawrence Lee Hewitt.
This week was the penultimate show of the Vicksburg story arc. Do you know what that means, Tracy?
It means next to last, Rich.
That's correct. So next week will be the final show of the Vicksburg story arc. And although we'll mention what happened down at Port Hudson, we won't get into much detail about it. So if you'd like to look into the Confederate defense and federal capture of Port Hudson on your own, then we recommend you pick up Port Hudson, Confederate Bastion on the Mississippi by Lawrence Lee Hewitt.
And then we were thinking that between Vicksburg and Gettysburg, we might spend one or a couple of episodes looking at the story of the 54th Massachusetts and the assault on Fort Wagner down at Charleston. But upon reflection, we've decided to save that story until after we're done with Gettysburg.
So here's what's going to happen. We'll finish up Vicksburg next week, which will be the first weekend in October. Then we're going to take a 2-week break, and then we'll start Gettysburg. That means the first Gettysburg episode will be the last weekend of October. To recap, finish Vicksburg next week, 2-week break, start Gettysburg the last weekend of October.
And how many episodes will it take us to do Gettysburg, Rich?
Well, Tracy, it looks like we'll spend 5 episodes on Gettysburg, one for background, then one show for each day of the 3-day battle, then one episode to wrap it all up. So there you go, Gettysburg in 5 episodes.
Really?
No.
Really? No.
No, not really. We'll probably spend 5 episodes just talking about the pivotal decision to cast Sam Elliott as John Buford in the Gettysburg movie.
Okay.
You know what's going to happen here in the morning, Tracy? Whole damn Reb Army's going to be here.
Okay.
Rebels will hit us just about first light. Keep a clear eye. Let's have the pickets give us a good warning. All right, gentlemen. Let's get posted.
Okay. Well.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Civil War, 1861 to 1865, a history podcast. Tracy and I do hope that you'll join us again next week for the final show in the Vicksburg story arc. But until then, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.